Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest for this show is Daniel Pinchbeck. Daniel Pinchbeck's latest book is called Notes from the Edge Times. He's also the author of 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and some other books as well. And he lives in New York, and we are here at the Prophets Conference in Palm Springs, California, in the winter of 2011. So 2012 is coming right up. It's a pretty hot subject. And you've also written about psychedelics. I don't have the name of those books right in front of me, Daniel, but just to let people know, and I imagine that informs some of your opinions and concerns. Does it?
Definitely. I mean, that was my first book, Breaking Open the Head, was about psychedelic drugs and shamanism, and I sort of charted my shift over time. I grown up as a sort of scientific materialist, rationalist, nihilist, and had an existential crisis in my late 20s and remembered my psychedelic experiences from college. So I went on a whole quest around the world where I went to West Africa. I went through tribal initiation in the Bwiti tribe of Gabon, visited the Amazon in Ecuador, worked with taking ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic from the Amazon. I visited the Mazatec Indians in Mexico where they work with mushrooms. And went through a change in kind of my belief system to accepting that there were these psychic levels of reality and that shamanism had a lot of validity. And that opened me to the idea that there might be legitimate, prophetic understandings of the future coming through these different cultures, such as the Hopi talk about or the classical Maya talked about. So that led me to the second book, 2012. Mm-hmm.
I guess there's been a lot of prophecies about this particular time. You probably know a lot more about that than I do.
It's a very complicated and very confusing because, yes, definitely, I mean, as far as we know, there's even some argument about it there, but the Maya did see that December 21st, 2012 was the end of a 5,125-year cycle. You know, other cultures seem to be pointing towards this time, the Hopi prophecies, but then you could also look at the Jewish 6,000-year calendar, the Christian ideas around apocalypse and transformation, the Hindu yuga cycle, which, you know, according to some people are very vast cycles, but then according to other sources, there actually is a meaning in this period. But specifically, this idea of, importance of 2012, it comes from the classical Maya.
Well, I've heard a lot of different interpretations, including by different indigenous people. It's pretty obvious humans have created, some of us in particular, have created not a good situation and have had not a very positive relationship with nature and the earth and so much of basically raping the earth, raping our home. I always say, can't get much stupider than ruining your own nest.
Yeah, well, that's the process that in this country continues to be well underway. And in my books, I looked at it in a lot of different ways, but almost like denigration of nature, hatred of nature and the body and the feminine, including feminine aspects of consciousness, like intuition and vision. And, you know, we're still seeing that. I mean, you know, the Monsanto just got permission to use alfalfa. We don't know what the long-term damage from that could be. I mean, I was just reading an article in the Times today about hydrofracking. You know, they're desperate to get the natural gas out, so they're now pouring radioactive wastes into the rivers and so on. I mean, we're definitely seem to be reaching the end point of a logic, of a systemic logic around nature, around the ego, around business, around corporations, around the nation state. And although that's very scary, it could also be something really amazing because we could be in this transitional time between two worldviews, two ways of being on the earth.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this conference, the Prophets Conference, is the first time I've heard people actually talking in big groups about the possibility of human extinction, which is, I think, a good thing that people are talking about it, because it's always better to be talking, in my opinion, to be talking about things than not talking about them, and especially if you're looking to do something about it. And it's pretty heavy duty, and most people don't like to think about it. So that's one of the issues. And just seeing in your film, 2012, that I just finished watching a little while ago. And it's the beginning, the first half, would you say, is sort of stating the problems, and the second half is talking about things we can do about it. And I've been very involved in those kinds of things we can do about it for the last 10 years or something. It's been a while I've been knowing about this. So that's wonderful. And is your film widely distributed, or do you want to say anything about the film? It must have been a lot of work.
The film was a brutal amount of work, and especially for the director, but for me also. It's called 2012 Time for Change. It's now out on DVD. You can get DVDs through our website, 2012timeforchange.com. Then we're also now on iTunes. And we interviewed all sorts of people, celebrities like Sting and Ellen Page and David Lynch, then a lot of ecological visionaries and shamans and activists and Buckminster Fuller devotees and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you went all over the place. That's great. Because, well, what do you think, what is your impression going all over the place? I think you travel around a lot and talk to a lot of people. And what overall impression do you come away with that you could generalize about where kind of people are at, or are they waking up, or I suppose that's who you would rub elbows with the most. The people that aren't interested would probably not even know about you.
I think there's like a huge awakening happening, and obviously we're seeing that in the Middle East right now with what's happened with Egypt and other countries around there. And basically the social media, the social technologies are allowing people to find each other on the basis of affinities, and then also discover, you know, other sources of information outside of the mainstream news and the mainstream media. So that's a really, you know, tremendous development, you know. Mm-hmm. And I see people who even didn't have any interest in this kind of stuff, you know, people who, you know, might have seemed superficial, you know, a few years ago to me, are waking up to it. In fact, I started writing a column now for an English fashion magazine called Dazed and Confused. And the publisher of that magazine, who came out of the fashion world, is seeing the value of, shamanic experience, the fact that there's political transformation happening. So I feel there's a large-scale awakening happening that the mainstream media is still kind of concealing and avoiding.
Well, since the mainstream media is owned by these corporations that are kind of in on the deal, that's not too surprising. Could you say a little bit more about shamanism for the audience who may not know quite what you're talking about? Some do, some don't, no doubt.
Shamanism, first of all, the word is from Siberia, but now it's been kind of generalized, kind of spiritual practice of tribal people, traditional societies, often ones that don't have a written language. And shamans in those cultures are traditionally people who would have direct contact with the spirit worlds, and they would go into visionary trance states using different means and modalities that include visionary plants or fasting or sleep deprivation. They would make contact with spirits. They would bring back information for the tribe. They would be able to perform healings and so on. And of course, the shaman is kind of an archetype that we've kind of created now. I mean, in Amazonian cultures, those powers could also be used for darkness. You know, what we call a shaman could heal somebody, but he could also kill somebody with a magical dart or something. But in general, I see the revival of an interest in shamanism as being a very positive phenomenon, along with the kind of continued growth in awareness of the value of Eastern metaphysical practices and disciplines. I feel that all of this is part of this transformation of global consciousness, which is happening in our time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, and you even went to Africa and did some Iboga, right? Which I understand, I had a friend who did that. It's just like unbelievably strong. So you've done a lot of things, really. And I don't know if you'd like to talk about some of those, but it sounds like you've really been crammed a lot into your life in the last few, I don't know if it's been the last few years or even longer, but share what you feel like. And we also will urge people to get your film, then they get to see as well as hear.
I underwent initiation with Iboga in Gabon. It was like a 20-hour trip where I saw different aspects of my early life and inklings into my future life and little visions of other, you know, all sorts of things. As I said, I mean, I already kind of mentioned the different, you know, and I've continued to do ayahuasca. I mean, actually, We now have a web magazine. I have a web magazine, Reality Sandwich, and a social network, Evolver.net. And we're organizing some retreats. At the end of March, we're bringing people to Colombia to visit the Kogi Indians and also doing some of ayahuasca work while we're down there. Mm-hmm. So for me, that remains kind of a part of my personal journey, as well as something that you know, I write about. And on Reality Sandwich, we have a lot of essays by different authors about shamanism, about non-ordinary states of consciousness, philosophy of consciousness, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a wide range of things that you're interested and concerned about, and that we all should be, as a matter of fact. So I'm not sure where you'd like to, what you'd like to share with a listening audience next.
Well, I mean, you know, when my book 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, came out in 2006, the main question I asked from people, and the book was a very philosophical look at, you know, the nature of consciousness, what these type of transformations could mean, how we take our Western systems of thought and logic and kind of integrate them with more of these indigenous and Eastern ways of understanding reality. So I looked at a lot of philosophers like Heidegger and Nietzsche and so on. But so the question I got asked by people all over the place was, what, if we understand, you know, that there's this change happening, then what do we do? So my efforts and my work since then have been to kind of address that. So the film addressed that, and also what we've been doing with Evolver was basically kind of trying to put ideas into practice. So we have a social network, Evolver.net. Also, we're doing video courses on EvolverIntensives.com. And we have this web magazine, Reality Sandwich. What we're doing with Evolver is we've created what we call the Evolver Social Movement. So we have about 45 groups that meet up every month in different towns and cities in the U.S., but actually around the world at this point, including like South Africa and Budapest and London and so on. And we create a theme between the organizers and the headquarters. And then people come together. It could be on, you know, peace activism or the future of psychedelics or local resilience or whatever. So they range from kind of metacosmic to kind of local and practical. And the idea is really to create a scaffolding for a new type of social movement to emerge, one that's really based on kind of questioning, you know, everything that we've been told is true, but then also giving people practical tools to work on transforming their local environments.
Yeah, well, that's really good, and it's really hard, I find, to get people to pay attention to these matters, because I don't know about you, but I'm often called, you know, I'm too negative, like as if it's my fault, you know, as if you don't talk about it, it won't be happening. But these issues of a lot of things, water being one of them, that's for sure. And that people don't even have a clue about, because they're busy. The other kind of media, other than the one you're hearing this on, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the left has tended to kind of make a little bit of a mistake in being so much about the negative and so much about what they're against. Like, if I look at Alternet, you know, on the web or whatever, everything is like, oh no, this terrible thing they're doing, that terrible thing that they're doing. And I think that it's like, it's not, that's not really like a way that's going to inspire people, you know, to kind of build a movement. One reason among many that I think that the shamanic experience and a realization that there are other levels of the psyche and other dimensions of consciousness beyond what we've been, you know, told about is so important is that it actually gives us something to kind of be excited about and thrilled about for the future. There's actually a lot of mystery out there and a lot of things that we can't really explain, and maybe kind of a purpose for human beings beyond what we now understand or know. I mean, the left has inherited the materialist kind of tendencies, you know, that are, you know, scientific materialist, Marxist, Leninist, you know, it's like all kind of part of a package, you know. I mean, one of the movements that's going on right now, which really interests me, is called Zeitgeist. There's the Zeitgeist social movement, similar to the Evolver social movement. And they have this idea that resources are the only important thing, and the world should be divided into a resource-based economy. And in some ways, they have a lot of good ideas, but it's also very, very materialist. So I feel like, you know, what we're kind of offering is a counter-ideology or idea around recognizing that there's, you know, a much greater cosmic narrative happening that we can become part of.
Mm-hmm. You know? Like what is that? This cosmic narrative.
Well, in my books, for instance, in 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, I wrote at great length about the crop circle phenomenon in England, mm-hmm. and spent some time there and began as a skeptic and ended up talking to scientists, biophysicists, researchers, and so on, and visiting tons of the crop circles. And so through all this research, I ended up thinking that, or pretty much convinced, that it's not a human-made phenomenon entirely, that there's definitely another form of intelligence that's communicating with us. And we're seeing around the world a rise in UFO sightings, people seeing massive ships over in New York and in Mexico City. And, you know, I think that it just makes sense that if we look at how far we've come in 200 years, you know, like 200 years ago we barely had electricity. Now we have Blackberries and jet fighters and spaceships. Imagine civilization exists on another planet and it goes 5,000, 100,000, a million years beyond where we are now. They're going to have unbelievably extraordinary capabilities. And of course they would know that we're here, and of course they would be kind of interacting with us.
As you talk about crop circles, I don't know that the listeners all know what crop circles are, but they appear overnight, and they tend to be very, very beautiful and moving. I have pictures in wheat fields where the wheat is bent over. So just in case you didn't know what that was about. It's interesting that you say the left is so materialistic. I mean, I don't know if you're going the left. There's so many people, I mean, of all political persuasions, that just don't even think about any of this stuff. They just don't. Well, for one thing, they're not encouraged to think about it. So I think that that's kind of daunting. That's what I was talking about when I said about, you know, being called negative, because there are very serious things in a lot of people. Well, it's always back to the media.
The way that you encourage people to think about unfamiliar stuff is you have to make them see the possibility of a better life. Mm-hmm. If it's just another headache or another hardship, right, in a life that's already full of horrible, right, annoyances, people just can't face it. Right. You know? And that, I feel, has been a big problem of the left. You know?
Yeah. Well, there are things to do, and who knows? Like, live sustainably, and a lot of your film, well, the second part of your film, I guess, is about how to do things sustainably and how to do restorative things that will put things back in balance, essentially, because if so much is out of balance, and that balance really needs to be found in inner and outer in all kinds of ways, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the next generations may not be aware of this yet, the younger generations, but they're going to be, you know, in all likelihood, the cleanup crew, you know, because it's the party of post-industrial capitalism is about to shut down. And if we're going to survive in any form as a species, you know, we're going to need to do a tremendous amount of effort to restore the natural systems that we've depleted and injured and so on. But, you know, once again, if, and I think just from a materialist perspective, there's no juice there, you know, but if you take it as a spiritual task and recognize that there is a larger karmic forces at work in the universe, then, you know, potentially some of that work can be taken on joyfully rather than just as drudgery.
Mm-hmm. Even without that, it makes sense to do so many things that people don't know about. But what's happening with the big corporations and everything is they're just trying to get more stuff out of the ground, and that's what, you know, people think that we have to have these things. I mean, many people, not everybody by any chance. And I'm feeling like there's been a shift in this matter in terms of people knowing about it, but it's not like you know, the main conversation going on. And it's interesting that you use the 2012, that's the name of your film, and what's your website again?
Well, there's a couple of websites, Reality Sandwich and Evolver, mm-hmm. and then obviously the film is the title of the film, which is 2012, mm-hmm. Time for Change.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but, you know, I'm just in my own world, like everybody's in their own world, about how many people are thinking about it. They're thinking about where their money, you know, unemployment gets worse and worse and that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, the problems are systemic, and so you need to have systemic solutions, right? I mean, you can't even really blame BP for the Gulf oil spill, really, because, you know, the corporation operates in the stock market. They have to maximize value for shareholders, which means that automatically they have to cut corners in every way. So ultimately, we're going to need to reinvent our economic model. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it in the film through the works of Bernard Lyotard. I also discuss it a lot in this new book, Notes from the Edge Times. Different types of currencies that could have different, inscribe different values into the culture. So, for instance, a negative interest currency where money loses value the longer that you hold on to it. So it's more of a trading currency than a storing of value. That type of currency could institute sharing as a normal practice rather than hoarding. That's an idea that Lyotard discusses. There's a lot of really interesting work being done in this area. There's a book called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization by Tom Greco. But, you know, really, if you think about it, there's no reason that our only real means of exchanging value should be, a currency that's instituted and controlled by a consortium of private banking interests working through central banks. It's just an accounting chip, you know. So that stranglehold has to be broken. And Greco proposes some means to do that, having local businesses issue local credit, as does Lyotard propose a bunch. We're actually publishing a book in the summer through Evolver called Sacred Economics by Charles Eisenstein. There's already a lot of really great articles by him on the site, but he also proposes different models for how the instruments for exchanging value in our society could be transformed so they support humane and ecological ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's great. That's really encouraging. I'll have to check into some of this. I don't know about it myself. Obviously, and the word needs to be spread, for sure. Because the sooner we make some changes, the better it'll be. I like this idea of the money. It goes down in value when you hold on to it longer. I mean, I guess that's the way it is with sometimes anyway, but for different reasons. That's interesting. Well, we just got a couple minutes left. Is there anything you'd like? Well, we need to have your website again. Anything else you'd like to say in closing? Daniel Pinchbeck.
Thank you very much for talking to me today. As I mentioned, the film is 2012, Time for Change, and it includes a lot of interviews with people like Sting and David Lynch and Gilberto Gil and environmentalists and so on, Chobbins. And the website is 2012timeforchange.com. Web magazine is realitysandwich.com. Social network is evolver.net. And on evolver.net, you can see there's a click for the regionals, and then you can see all the places that we currently have local Evolver groups, including Portland's.
Yeah, I think I just got invited to go to a meeting.
Yeah, it's like a prototype. You know, we're learning as we go how to, you know, get people connected and inspired.
That's terrific. Well, thank you so very much for your work, your books, your film. Your latest book is Notes from the Edge Times. Your film is 2012, Time for Change. And my guest, who has written these books and made these films and more books than these, you can find them on the website. And his name is Daniel Pinchbeck. Thank you very much for your time. I know it's been a push being at the conference and one thing and another. And my name's Sue Supriano, and thank you all for listening. Mm-hmm.